pray prayers that peel the paint off the walls, prayers that strip our souls bare, prayers that leave us limp on the floor, emptied of words. Gethsemane prayers. My mom has often told me the story of one of her most painful prayers. She calls it her Gethsemane prayer. She had been dating a guy for about 2 years, and she was sure a ring was coming soon. Instead, he pulled her aside one day and laid this one on her. "You know you're my first girlfriend ever, and now I'm worried that we got too serious too fast and I should have dated other people. There's this other girl I met, and I think I need to take her out to be sure. I need your permission to be sure." I know. Here's the part where we all want to throw a brick at him because my mom is the sweetest, most delightful soul ever to grace this planet. But my mom, being wise beyond her 21 years, swallowed her tears and said, "Sure, go ahead and take her out." Because she knew she did not want to marry a guy who wasn't crazy in love with her, even if she was crazy in love with him. It's no fun being crazy in love all by yourself. She either wanted him sure, and not just matter-of-fact sure, she wanted, "You are the greatest woman in the universe, and I will never even blink at another woman as long as I live, sure," or not at all. But she went home and got on her face and prayed all night. In that prayer, she gave the relationship over to God. She begged God to work and to clarify and to hit her boyfriend in the head with a hammer. No, I mean, help her boyfriend think clearly. To either help him realize he was madly greatest woman in the universe in love with her, or to help her let go. She prayed and surrendered her future to God's loving hands, knowing that even if her boyfriend let her down, God never would. In the morning, she got up red-eyed and exhausted, but at peace. The boyfriend came back a few days later, tail between his legs, begging forgiveness. Turns out he didn't want or need to take the other girl out after all. He'd just gotten scared. Months later, he was down on one knee proposing. Now, 40-plus years of marriage later, my dad still gazes goopy-eyed at Mom across the dinner table and spouts random poetry at her wonderfulness. Now, 4 decades later, Mom still refers back to that Gethsemane prayer as a turning point in her walk with God when she learned to pour out her pain to God, to beg him for what she wanted, but then humbly submit to his loving care, to trust that even if people made mistakes, God could set things right. The line we shouldn't cross. Having said all that, here is something to consider as we borrow from the Psalms. There is a line that even the angry psalmists don't cross in prayer. They wish horrors on their enemies. Keep in mind that Jesus' lesson on forgiving more than 70 times 7 times hadn't yet been preached, but never do they turn their anger on God. They question God, but don't accuse. They stop short of pointing the finger. The psalmists might say, "People are saying this about you, God. Will you stand by and let them think that? Prove them wrong." But they don't say, "I charge you of wrongdoing, God. I am angry with you. I resent your decisions and authority. I give up on you." They maintain a respect for God's authority versus their own humanity, acknowledging their own limited perspective and power. Take David's Psalm 13 as an example, which we explored in the vignette. It opens in the depths, but climbs back up to praise. "How long, Lord, will you forget me forever? How long will you hide your face from me? How long must I wrestle with my thoughts and day after day have sorrow in my heart? But I trust in your unfailing love. My heart rejoices in your salvation. I will sing the Lord's praise, for he has been good to me. Psalm 13 verses 1 and 2, and 5 and 6. This psalm and many others can guide our own prayers, teaching us how to view ourselves in light of God's might, reminding us that He is God and we are not, helping us to find praise in the midst of pain, helping us to appreciate who God is and what He has given, even while we beg for relief, guiding us in respectfully stating our case before God, confessing the depths of our hurt without pointing a haughty finger, showing us how to lament but not complain. In the book 1,000 Gifts, Ann Voskamp beautifully describes the difference between complaint and lament. Lament is a cry of belief in a good God, a God who has His ear to our hearts, a God who transfigures the ugly into beauty. Complaint is the bitter howl of unbelief in any benevolent God in this moment, a distrust in the love beat of the Father's heart. God's anger kindles hot when the essence of the complaint implies doubt in His love. The more I learn His love, the less likely I am to Israelite complain, and the more I genuinely lament, complaint that trusts His heart. Complaint landed the Israelites in big trouble with God. Snakes, plagues, 40 years of wandering. But lament is a perfectly acceptable cry from a desperate heart. God welcomes our cries, invites our questions, shoulders our fears. But let us guard against the bitter acid of distrust that erodes the heart and disintegrates the relationship. Let us resist the resentment that rankles, taking the fragrant incense of prayer and souring it to acrid smoke. Let's pray like Jesus, honest, respectful, surrendered. Let's pray like David, open, raw, redeeming pain with praise. Remember to thank and praise. The best way to keep the right posture in prayer, to maintain a spirit of humility and surrender even as we are hurting, is gratitude. A reading of the Psalms uncovers a pattern. Many of the most despairing Psalms still find a way to praise and thank God from the darkness. See Psalms 37, 40, 42, and 89 for a few examples. When we are sad and frustrated and tired of waiting, how easy it is to forget to thank God. We have to choose to praise God for His kindness, generosity, and power. We have to remember to thank Him for gifts already given. If you are stuck in your walk with God, waiting for a blessing that won't come, try bringing gratitude and praise back into your prayer life. Surely He has blessed you in the past. Even as you beg God for what you lack, make a point always to end your prayers with gratitude. That simple discipline will transform your perspective. Praise reminds us of His power. Gratitude reminds us of His goodness. Together, praise and gratitude protect our hearts and restore our hope. Choose your playlist. So, what if you have been doing all this, praying, pouring out your soul, praising through pain, but the silence on God's end is still killing you? When we are navigating a waiting season and the journey takes unexpected detours, Satan tries to run his cruel soundtrack in our minds. God doesn't like you. God is against you. God is not listening. But God has a soundtrack too. Maybe it's time to put together a new spiritual playlist. Let's choose to fill our minds with God's playlist, scriptures and songs that fuel our faith and protect our relationship. God is not silent as He sometimes seems. He has already given us His word to tell us how He feels and how He works. It's up to us to use the Bible to fill in God's half of the conversation. Here are some scriptures on my faith-building playlist. When I feel forgotten or abandoned by God, I read, "Can a mother forget the baby at her breast and have no compassion on the child she has born? Though she may forget, I will not forget you." Isaiah chapter 49, verse 15. When I feel ignored by God, tired of the wait, I read, "Why do you complain, Jacob? Why do you say, Israel, my way is hidden from the Lord, my cause is disregarded by my God? Do you not know? Have you not heard? The Lord is the everlasting God, the creator of the ends of the earth. He will not grow tired or weary, and his understanding no one can fathom. He gives strength to the weary and increases the power of the weak. Even youths grow tired and weary, and young men stumble and fall. But those who hope in the Lord will renew their strength. They will soar on wings like eagles. They will run and not grow weary. They will walk and not be faint." Isaiah chapter 40, verses 27 through 31. When I feel unimportant to God, I read, "Are not two sparrows sold for a penny? Yet not one of them will fall to the ground outside your Father's care. And even the very hairs of your head are all numbered. So don't be afraid. You are worth more than many sparrows." Matthew chapter 10, verses 29 through 31. When I feel disliked by God or insecure in his love, I read, "This is love, not that we loved God, but that he loved us and sent his Son as an atoning sacrifice for our sins. And so we know and rely on the love God has for us. God is love. Whoever lives in love lives in God and God in them. This is how love is made complete among us, so that we will have confidence on the day of judgment. In this world, we are like Jesus. There is no fear in love, but perfect love drives out fear, because fear has to do with punishment. The one who fears is not made perfect in love." 1 John chapter 4, verses 10 and 16 through 18. When I feel frustrated by God's slowness, I read, "With the Lord, a day is like 1,000 years, and 1,000 years are like a day. The Lord is not slow in keeping his promise, as some understand slowness. Instead, he is patient with you, not wanting anyone to perish, but everyone to come to repentance." 2 Peter chapter 3, verses 8 and 9. Scriptures like this remind us that when God allows us to wait for something, it doesn't mean he is mad at us. When we are wandering and wondering, David's story and countless other scriptures like these can reset our thinking, protect our trust, and transform our perspective. Reclaim the refuge of prayer. When Satan conspires with fear and insecurity to turn prayer into a battleground, let's fight back. David fought many enemies in his life, but God wasn't one of them. By fighting alongside God, not against him, David enjoyed prayer as a lifelong refuge, a haven where he waited out and waded through the long, lonely wilderness years. You and I can experience the same. When the waiting ended and David overcame his enemies and claimed the promised throne, he wrote a song of praise. "In my distress, I called to the Lord. I cried to my God for help. From his temple, he heard my voice. My cry came before him into his ears. He rescued me from my powerful enemy, from my foes who were too strong for me. They confronted me in the day of my disaster, but the Lord was my support. He brought me out into a spacious place. He rescued me because he delighted in me. Psalm 18, verses 6 and 17 through 19. Let prayer remain our refuge year after year, however long we wander in the waiting wilderness. Let us never give up on prayer, even when God feels far away. If we run out of words, let us sit and keep company with God, knowing that even in the silence, He sees, He hears, and He cares. Let us borrow words from David and others who have waited and prayed before us. Let us keep praying all of our days. Let us remember to thank and praise along the way. And when our waiting season ends, however it ends, let us celebrate with the one who has seen us through, heard us out, and never left our side. Waiting Room Reading. For further study. David's life takes up a lot of biblical real estate, starting in 1 Samuel chapter 16 and going all the way through the end of 2 Samuel. You can also find David's story in 1 Kings chapter 1 and in 1 Chronicles chapters 10 through 29. Journal prompt. Do you need to work through any negative feelings toward God so you can remain close to Him? What scriptures can fill your spiritual playlist, filling in God's half of the conversation? How can you bring gratitude and praise back into your prayer life? Prayer prompt. Be merciful to me, Lord, for I am in distress. My eyes grow weak with sorrow, my soul and body with grief. But I trust in you, Lord. I say you are my God. My times are in your hands. Psalm 31, verses 9 and 14 through 15.
Chapter 6. Squeaky Wheels and Little Old Ladies. Jacob's Story. Until You Bless Me. Based on Genesis chapter 32, verses 22 through 32. Sleep will not come. Every time Jacob shuts his eyes, he sees Esau, red beard, hard eyes, sharp sword, leading 400 men, hunting Jacob and his family. Minutes limp by, every second an age. He sits up, watches the swollen river sluice, shredding the moon's reflection to rippling ribbons. Across the river, through trees at shore's edge, he can just make out a flickering amber smudge, a fire around which his wives and children sleep. He is glad he sent them across the ford ahead of him, glad of the space alone to think and plan and pray. Though time feels stalled tonight, tomorrow will come too soon. At the end of it, Jacob will either be reunited with Esau, the brother he swindled 20 years ago, offering apologies, accepting forgiveness, making introductions, or Jacob and his family will all be dead. Hours earlier, the breathless messengers had sprinted into camp, shouting warnings. Esau is leading a mass of armed men, and they're marching this way. Scores of anxious eyes turned on Jacob, the eyes of his wives, his sons, his daughter, his slaves. Jacob had forced a laugh, loud and confident. Oh, that's just Esau showing off for his brother. This is his idea of a grand welcoming committee. Everyone had laughed, relieved and excited. But now, here alone by the water, Jacob's veins ice over with terror. 400 men isn't a welcoming committee. It's an army. A twig snaps. Suddenly tense, Jacob listens hard. Every muscle coils, ready to spring. For a moment, all he hears is river nudging against the rocky shore. Snap, snap, crunch. Jacob leaps to his feet, sword at the ready. Who's there? Into the soft glow of the fire steps a man, taller than a man should be, broad-shouldered, bristling with golden weapons. Immediately, Jacob knows this is no ordinary man. He has met messengers from the Lord before. They deliver instructions, warnings, and, if you are fortunate, blessings. Jacob lowers his sword and drops to one knee. My lord. The man inclines his head. You have a message for me from God. The man shakes his head. The firelight plays tricks, keeps his face in the dark, where Jacob cannot read his expression. Jacob feels a stab of worry. A warning about Esau. Silence again. A twitch that might be a head shake, no. A blessing, then. Still silence. Jacob stands up, bewildered. The man turns as if to leave, to melt back into the shadows from which he came. Wait, don't just leave without words, Jacob says. His thoughts are spinning, plotting. He remembers the famous family story passed down about his grandfather, Abraham, how he fed the messengers of God all those years ago. During that meal, the Lord finally delivered the promise Abraham had been waiting for. Perhaps food would be the way to this angel's heart, too, the way to access his promises. A plan forms quickly, and Jacob turns on his charming voice, the one that almost always gets him his way. At least share a meal with me. I have fresh lamb, prepared just this afternoon by my beautiful wife Rachel. He feels his face shine with the familiar wheedling smile. Please. The man takes another step back. Anger sparks inside, given greater fuel by fear. Say something, Jacob demands, louder than he intends. The man's expression seems to darken. The shadows painting his face deepen. Jacob lowers his voice with an effort. Please. He holds trembling hands out to the man, beseeching. In a dream, the Lord told me to come back home. He promised we'd be safe, but now Esau is bearing down on us. I camped here alone this night to seek God, to seek blessing, to seek safety for my family tomorrow. I need your blessing. The faces of his family flick through his mind. Rachel, Joseph, Leah, Reuben, Simeon, all needing him, depending on him for protection. What if the Lord had led his family to slaughter? What if God was finally letting Esau take his revenge? The angel shrugs and turns away. With a roar of desperation, Jacob springs after him and locks his arms around the man's waist. With a grunt, they both fall to the ground. Jacob's chin bangs against the man's elbow. He tastes blood but does not let go. The man tries to yank free from Jacob's grip. His arms are hard as iron rods. Jacob clings tighter, and he speaks through gritted teeth. I will not let you go until you bless me. He shifts his grip, tries to wrap his legs around the man's neck. At last the angel speaks. I will not, he says, flipping Jacob over onto his back. The air rushes out of Jacob's lungs, leaving him stunned. Levi, Judah, Dan. Still gasping, Jacob brings a knee into the man's gut. The man buckles, and now Jacob is on top. Naphtali. Gad, Asher, I can do this forever, Jacob pants, grappling to pin the man's arms to the ground. Issachar, Zebulun, Dinah, I don't give up. Jacob thinks he hears a smile in the man's voice. And I don't give in. The angel jerks one arm free and smashes an elbow into Jacob's temple. Galaxies wheel across his vision. We'll see about that, Jacob grunts. Stars keep dancing, but Jacob keeps fighting.
Let's be honest, Jacob wasn't exactly a spiritual giant. Far from it, actually. He lied to his father, stole his brother Esau's birthright, oh, and while he was at it, he took his blessing, too, then ran away. Not the kind of stand-up guy you'd expect to become the father of the nation of Israel. But Jacob had one thing going for him. He fought for what he wanted. Here on the night before the brothers reunite, a meeting that very well may get Jacob killed, Jacob encounters a messenger from God and recognizes an opportunity. In one of the Bible's more bizarre scenes, Jacob grabs the angel, demands a blessing, and refuses to let go until he gets what he wants. All night, the men wrestle, locked in battle. This story has always fascinated me. Honestly, it's weird. But I think God put it in the Bible to tell us some things about himself and about prayer. God calls us to persistence in prayer. God values persistence and perseverance. In fact, he calls us to them. Jacob's perseverance this night earns him a blessing, a name, and a limp. We'll come back to the limp later. Time and again, God urges us to persist in goodness, in hope, and especially in prayer. Take these passages as just a tiny sampling. Let us not become weary in doing good, for at the proper time, we will reap a harvest if we do not give up. Galatians chapter 6, verse 9. Keep asking, and it will be given to you. Keep searching, and you will find. Keep knocking, and the door will be opened to you. For everyone who asks receives, and the one who searches finds, and to the one who knocks, the door will be opened. Matthew chapter 7, verses 7 through 8, Holman Christian Standard Bible. The Bible encourages us not just to present our requests to God, but to present them repeatedly. Let's take a closer look at Jesus' classic parable about the persistent widow. I know you're probably thinking, I'm reading a book about waiting. Persistent widow is my middle name. Great storyteller that Jesus was, I imagine him telling this story with an affectionate smile on his face, maybe pulling off a funny impersonation of a feisty old woman. Who doesn't know a little old lady down the street who just won't give up until she gets her way? Then Jesus told his disciples a parable to show them that they should always pray and not give up. He said, "In a certain town, there was a judge who neither feared God nor cared what people thought. And there was a widow in that town who kept coming to him with the plea, 'Grant me justice against my adversary.' For some time, he refused. But finally, he said to himself, 'Even though I don't fear God or care what people think, yet because this widow keeps bothering me, I will see that she gets justice so that she won't eventually come and attack me.' And the Lord said, 'Listen to what the unjust judge says. And will not God bring about justice for his chosen ones who cry out to him day and night? Will he keep putting them off? I tell you, he will see that they get justice, and quickly.'" Luke chapter 18, verses 1 through 8. Always pray. Don't give up. The lesson of the parable is clear. God doesn't mind repetitive prayers. In fact, he invites them. But unlike the judge in Jesus' story, our God is not unjust or uncaring. He is a compassionate father who loves justice and wants to see his children happy. Our persistence proves that we are serious, shows him what we really want and need. When I think about this from a parenting perspective, it makes sense. My children make dozens of requests every day, sometimes hundreds, till I feel like a pinball being boinged around kid to kid. "Tie my shoe! Ping! Where's my toy? Ping! I need cheese! Ping! I need to go!" Many, perhaps most, of these requests are passing whims, not true desires. When my oldest child was nearly four, and believe me, it still thrills me to be able to speak those three beautiful words, "my oldest child." My means she is mine. Oldest means there's more than one child who belongs to me. Child is what I prayed to hold all those long nights. She grew obsessed with all things princess. As summer rounded the corner to fall and Christmas began looming in the not-so-distant future, she fixated on only one Christmas request, the pink dress that Ariel wears when she first becomes human in The Little Mermaid. You don't remember that dress, you say? Neither does anyone else, since Ariel only wears the dress for 73 seconds in the film. But my beloved daughter wanted one, so off I set, searching the world for the pink dress. It did not exist. At first, I tried the old distraction technique, showing Cassidy picture after picture of other princess dresses. Don't you love Cinderella's blue dress? No? Look at this yellow bell dress with ruffles. No? Oh, look at this amazing wedding-y aerial dress. Isn't that even more gorgeous than the pink dress? But Cassidy stood firm, didn't even bat an eye at the other unworthy imitations. So I tried the old give-it-time technique. Surely she would forget about the dress after a while, move on to something else. She was 4. How long could her attention span be? But as December descended, bringing cold and Christmas trees, Cassidy insisted. The pink dress. Still the pink dress. Only the pink dress. Exactly as it looked in the film. After so many months of her unflagging refrain, I gave in, finally convinced. The pink dress really was her heart's desire. I had to find a way. So I conscripted a seamstress friend to design and sew the world's first pink aerial princess dress. Come Christmas morning, Cassidy was all swirling pink skirts, all little girl glee. I had never seen her happier. Her persistence had paid off. I suspect our interactions with God in prayer sometimes work like this. He is not withholding gifts just to be stingy or mean. He's just giving us time to search our hearts and discover our true desires. Are you beginning to feel stupid asking God for the same thing over and over, day after day, for months or years on end? Don't. Are you wondering if God thinks you are being annoying or pushy or selfish? He doesn't. It's not wrong to be the squeaky wheel, the persistent widow who keeps asking. Remember, God encouraged us to do it. Sometimes God changes his mind. It would have been easy for Cassidy to give up on her dress, to let me talk her out of it. But she didn't. She knew what she wanted. It would have been easy for Jacob to give up the fight, admit he was outmatched. But he didn't. He knew what he needed. Sometimes when we've been waiting for a long time, we give up on praying because we think, God's already decided what's going to happen, so why should I bother telling him what I want? He's just going to do what he wants anyway. Not necessarily. Ready to take a deeper doctrinal dive? Hold your breath. In chapter 1, I hinted at a theological mind-bender. When we pray, we usually expect one of three answers from God. Yes, no, or wait. But I suggest that he offers a fourth response. Maybe. Ask me again. You might talk me into it. Consider Jacob's grandfather, Abraham, known as the father of the faithful. In Genesis chapter 18, verse 20, we find that the city of Sodom has become a sin-saturated blight, and God has decided to destroy it. The decision has been made, the demolition day already set. It's a done deal. But Abraham convinces God to reconsider. At first, Abraham's request is tentative. Will you really sweep it away and not spare the place for the sake of the 50 righteous people in it? Far be it from you to do such a thing. Will not the judge of all the earth do right? Verses 24 and 25. I suspect Abraham cringes here, waiting for God's answer, wondering if he's crossed the line, made God angry. But you know what? God listens to Abraham. He changes his plan and agrees to spare the city if 50 righteous people can be found. But Abraham isn't done bargaining. He says, "Now that I have been so bold as to speak to the Lord, though I am nothing but dust and ashes, what if the number of the righteous is 5 less than 50? Verses 27 through 28. Again, God agrees. From 45 people to 40 to 30 to 20, all the way down to 10, Abraham humbly talks God down, persuading him to spare the city of Sodom if he can find just 10 righteous souls there. God originally had a different plan, but Abraham convinces him to reconsider, to change. In the end, God still destroyed Sodom. He was willing to spare it, but could not find even 10 righteous people in the entire city. And Abraham wasn't the only one who talked God into changing his plan. Take a look at King Hezekiah, whose story appears in Isaiah chapter 38. In those days, Hezekiah became ill and was at the point of death. The prophet Isaiah, son of Amoz, went to him and said, "This is what the Lord says. Put your house in order, because you are going to die. You will not recover." Hezekiah turned his face to the wall and prayed to the Lord, "Remember, Lord, how I have walked before you faithfully and with wholehearted devotion, and have done what is good in your eyes." And Hezekiah wept bitterly. Then the word of the Lord came to Isaiah, "Go and tell Hezekiah, this is what the Lord, the God of your father David, says. I have heard your prayer and seen your tears. I will add 15 years to your life." Verses 1 through 5. What a story! God had decided that Hezekiah's time had come, and yet Hezekiah's prayer changed God's mind and Hezekiah's fate. What does this tell us? Our prayers make a difference. I have heard your prayer and seen your tears. So much love in such simple words. Just as we saw in Exodus chapter 3, verse 7, God sees, God hears, God cares. God, compassionate Father, sometimes changes his plans just because we, beloved children, ask him to. Lessons from Jesus' prayer life. Have the conversation. I'm not suggesting we will always get what we ask for, what we are waiting for. We won't. Sometimes we wait forever, ask 10,000 times, and in the end, we still get a no. And even when we do get the thing, it almost always comes to us differently than the way we had envisioned. Take God's very own son as an example. Let's step into another nighttime wrestling match. Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane, the night of his arrest. Jesus knows that the Father has firmly decided on a plan for saving mankind, and that plan involves Jesus' suffering and death. God has spent generations preparing the way, setting the stage. Messianic prophecies, a complex family tree in frequent need of dramatic rescue, crazy plagues, parted seas, unlikely heroes, a virgin birth, a midnight escape to Egypt. We are talking massive strategizing that spanned millennia and affected millions. After all this effort, the cross is to be God's crowning achievement, the consummate expression of his love for mankind. At last, the stage is set, the actors all in place, the curtain already rising. Jesus knows all this. He has spent years, a lifetime, preparing himself for this night, this sacrifice. But here in the final moments, Jesus asks God to change his mind. He pleads, "My Father, if it is possible, may this cup be taken from me." Jesus knows God probably won't say yes, can't say yes, however much he may want to. But even so, Jesus has the conversation. Jesus knows God more intimately than any of us ever will. The fact that Jesus asks God to change his mind, even in the final hours, tells us a lot about God. God is approachable. He invites our honest thoughts and will consider our requests even when they stand at odds with his plans. God is flexible. Jesus understood that God is flexible, open to considering our desires as he makes his plans. Sometimes, as we have seen with Abraham and Hezekiah, God can be convinced to alter his initial plan. In Jesus' case, God didn't change his mind, but he did go out of his way to comfort his son, even sending an angel to strengthen Jesus as he prayed. These stories give me hope and fuel my prayers. They convince me that our prayers matter. Yes, even the repetitive, squeaky wheel requests that we think God is sick of hearing. These stories renew my faith in prayer's appeal process. Prayer is no one-way conversation, however much it may sometimes feel that way. Our relationship with God involves give and take, and he cares about our opinions. God weighs our desires in light of his plans and our best interests, and sometimes he gives us what we want because we asked, because he cares. We get a say. I have seen all these principles of perseverance at work during my own waiting seasons. I started pursuing a writing career when I was 26, smack in the middle of our ongoing struggle to get pregnant. At first, things moved fast. I wrote my first novel, The 13th Summer, in 9.5 months. How clever, I thought, that even though I couldn't get pregnant at the time, birthing my first book baby took the exact same amount of time as growing a human baby. I went to a writer's conference, studied the industry, revised my work, sent queries to 7 literary agents, and bam, in a remarkably short time, I had signed with a fabulous literary agent who started shopping my work around to big New York book people. This is happening, I thought. I don't know why everybody says it's so hard to make it as a writer. I see what God is doing. He delayed me getting pregnant because he wanted to give me time to become a famous novelist. Wah, wah. So much for my reading God's mind ability. Turns out I was in for a lot of heartbreak and disappointment, for more rejections and years of working and waiting than my 26-year-old brain could have possibly fathomed. If you had told me that first year that I would still be waiting for a career break in 3 years, I would have swallowed hard. 5 years? I would have gone misty-eyed. 10 years? I would have tossed my laptop out the window. 13 years? I would have kung-fu'd you in the face. But let's check in at the 10 years waiting point. Now 36, I was crying in my parents' living room, venting to my entire family, throwing a full-on pity party, probably terrifying my new brother-in-law. I cried about how all my friends were at the point in their careers where they were making it, but here I was, stuck at square one, now without even a literary agent to represent my work. How I was beginning to wonder if God even wanted me to write. If I'd wasted 10 years of my life on an idiotic dream. If the 10 years of working and waiting were God's not-so-subtle way of saying, the answer is no, Elizabeth. A writing career isn't my will for you. Get a different dream. My family disagreed. They urged me to be careful not to get all Christian superstitious, attempting to interpret God's opinions based on life events. You can go back to chapter 4 if you want a more thorough discussion of the dangers of trying to read God's mind. It took 2 more long years of praying and writing, doubting and fighting, before I signed with a new agent. And then it took yet another 1.5 years before I got a book deal. But not in teen fiction, where I started out. My first book deal? Yep. You guessed it, for a Christian book called When God Says Wait. Let's just pause a moment so you can properly laugh your head off at me and marvel at God's sense of irony. I did not set out to write Christian books or nonfiction books or books for grown-ups. But through a winding 13-year journey and 10,000 prayers, God pointed me here, to the words I'm reading even now, prepared me to write this book, which I couldn't have written without those 13 miserable years. My desires informed God's decisions, and in time, He directed me to where He wanted me. We have seen how even Jesus was not spared drinking the cup of suffering God had set out for him. Jesus asked, but God said no. We don't know what God has planned for our lives. Will you get that promotion, that engagement ring, that healing? Because only God can answer for sure. But we do know that God welcomes our prayers, the repetitive, the heartbroken, the passionate, and He hears them. Though we are but dust and ashes, Genesis chapter 18, verse 27, our words matter. Our feelings matter. God takes our desires into account. Isaiah chapter 55, verses 8 through 9, tells us God's ways are higher than our ways, His thoughts higher than our thoughts. Although we can't fully comprehend the complex relationship between God's will, God's plans, and our desires, the Bible does indicate in 1,000 different ways that we get a say. Our desires inform God's decisions. He considers our feelings. God cares about our perspective, our free will, and our happiness. He wanted to hear Jesus' thoughts, Abraham's thoughts, Hezekiah's thoughts, Jacob's thoughts, and He wants to hear ours, yours and mine. We are not silent pawns in a celestial chess match, being moved around and sacrificed for the sake of God's big picture strategy. There is a conversation, a relationship, a give and take. The price of a wrestling match. Let's revisit Jacob's angelic encounter. All night they wrestle, man and God, and still, Jacob won't let go. Dawn breaks. Finally, the messenger gives in and gives Jacob his blessing, but Jacob is not left untouched. The angel dislocates Jacob's hip. The Hebrew word for dislocates can also mean makes lame, so it's possible that for the rest of his life, Jacob would walk with a limp. He receives a blessing, but the battle leaves a scar. Jacob is never quite the same. Greatly blessed, forever changed. He even gets a new name. Instead of Jacob, meaning he grabs the heel or he deceives, he becomes Israel, most likely meaning he struggles with God. Every waiting season in my life has left its mark on me. I have memories, scars, and honestly, I don't mind the scars anymore. They are part of me now. I wouldn't recognize myself without them. They make me who I am. The girl who loved a boy who didn't love her back. The girl who couldn't get pregnant. The girl who couldn't get a book deal. The girl whose future hangs trembling, uncertain, even now, as her husband considers a job change and a big move. She stands in the fork straining to see, nearsighted, frustrated, with two diverging paths, different futures, different lives, beckoning. Two places, two peoples she loves. Some of those questions have been resolved, some waits turned into yeses, some into nos, but I am still that girl. Still all of those girls. Different now, but still with the memories. Still with the scars. I have my wounds from waiting. You have yours. The rest of Jacob's life is defined as before and after this night. Before this prayer, he is Jacob. After, he is Israel. Another man entirely. Whatever you are waiting for right now, you may one day divide your life into before and after this season, these prayers. I can't tell you how this season of waiting will end, but end it will. Let's take a lesson from an unlikely teacher, Jacob. If there are blessings we want or things we need, let's ask boldly, persistently. When battles change us, even wound us, we can use our scars for good. They are reminders of God's power in our weakness, memories of his care and concern, marks that help us encourage friends in their sufferings. I've been down in that dirt. It gets better from here. Let's wrestle in prayer, roll in the dirt, grapple and bleed. Whatever God's final answer, we will be stronger for the struggle. Waiting Room Reading. For further study, read Jacob's life story and the story of his children in Genesis chapters 25 through 35 and 37 through 50. Journal prompt. Do you view God as being flexible and approachable? Do you think he wants to hear your persistent prayers, or do you secretly suspect you are annoying him? What scars has waiting given you? For better or worse, how have your waiting seasons already changed you? Prayer prompt. Relent, Lord. How long will it be? Have compassion on your servants. Satisfy us in the morning with your unfailing love, that we may sing for joy and be glad all our days. Make us glad for as many days as you have afflicted us, for as many years as we have seen trouble. May your deeds be shown to your servants, your splendor to their children. May the favor of the Lord our God rest on us. Establish the work of our hands for us. Yes, establish the work of our hands. Psalm 90, verses 13 through 17.
Chapter 7. The Friends Who See You Through. Ruth's Story, The Longest Day, based on Ruth chapters 3 and 4. Ruth eases the door open and tiptoes inside the tiny house she shares with her mother-in-law. Removing her sandals, she reaches for the water jug. She should be exhausted after the night she has had, but her heart is thrumming, her mind turning cartwheels. "Well?" a throaty voice calls out from the darkness. Ruth whirls around, brandishing the jug like a sword. Her mother-in-law cackles from her chair in the corner. A candle yawns to life, stretches toward the ceiling, revealing Naomi. "Mara," Ruth corrects herself for the 10,000th time, blanket wrapped in her chair, waiting for dawn, waiting for Ruth, and grinning. "I don't know what you had planned to do with that jug, but if I were a thief, I'd think twice before breaking in." Ruth feels her own laughter bubbling up to meet Mara's. How long has it been since she has heard Mara's raspy laugh? She finds her humor tangling with tears. Ruth's dead husband, Mahlon, used to get his mother laughing so hard her lungs would protest, till they all feared Naomi. She was Naomi then, pleasant, might laugh herself to death. But her laughter had died with her sons, and she had buried her smile with her husband. Only in recent months had the smile resurrected. "Pity the thief who defies the wrath of my pitcher," Ruth says, waving the jug around. "But mother," she bends a disapproving look on Mara, "you shouldn't have waited up all night." Clucking in disagreement, Mara heaves herself to her feet. The candlelight sparkles in her eyes, along with, is it hope Ruth sees shining there? "Well?" Mara's voice rings eager. "How did it go, daughter? Your night at Boaz's feet. Will he redeem our family property? Will he take you for his bride?" I think so." Careful words, calm voice. Life has taught Ruth not to hope too hard, or too soon. "Just as you said, he woke in the night and found me there at his feet." Warmth kindles in her cheeks. "He said if our kinsman redeemer does not want to redeem, then he, Boaz, will do it himself." Wrestling with a sudden shyness, Ruth ends on a whisper. Feeling Mara's eyes studying her, Ruth ducks her head and reaches for her shawl, unknotting it on the battered wooden table. "Look, Mother, he wouldn't let me come back empty-handed, so he gave me all this barley." A smile plays around her mouth. "He is very kind." Mara's wrinkled hand catches Ruth's elbow. "Mark my words, Boaz will not rest until the matter is settled." She squeezes so tight, Ruth bites back a squeak of pain. "Just wait, daughter. By tonight I will have found you a husband." She flashes an impish grin. "And what a husband Boaz will make. Wealthy, influential, and... he is gray, but still handsome, is he not?" "Mother!" Ruth swats at Mara's shoulder with the corner of her shawl. Cackling, Mara limps back to her chair. Hours crawl by. Ruth starts in on the barley, some for bread, some for stew, some for storage. When that doesn't fill enough time, she starts cleaning things that don't need cleaning. In her corner, Mara's fingers fly over the mending, but today she hums quietly. The humming is new, actually old, a long-lost habit from happier days. It wakes something in Ruth till she can hardly think, hardly breathe. Just before dusk, fists pound on the door. Muffled voices call, "Ruth, Mara, let us in, we have news." Eyes meet. Time stops. Mara's crinkled eyes reflect Ruth's own hectic feelings. "This is it." Ruth opens the door. Two old women barrel in, flattening Ruth against the table. "Took you long enough," says Rachel. "Like to catch our death," harumphs Anna, a tease in her voice. And then their words coil, overlapping, interrupting, and Ruth struggles to follow the looping thoughts. "Such news! She won't believe, will she, sister? No, not in her wildest..." "Aaron just came from the city gate. Everyone is talking." Ruth feels Mara's hand slip around hers and give a hard squeeze. "Aaron couldn't believe it himself. Oh yes, sister, he did seem shocked." "What's the news?" Mara's voice thunders over the chaos, and for 2 seconds the sisters fall silent, jaws hanging open. "Well, I never," huffs Rachel. Anna jumps back in, head bobbing. "The nerve talking to old friends." "Cousins, sister, we are cousins." Mara stomps her foot. "You're doing it again." She draws a deep breath, mouth twitching. "Rachel, dear, please just tell us the news. By yourself." Anna glowers, folds her arms across her ample bosom, presses her lips together. Ruth fights a laugh. Chest puffing up, Rachel rattles off a string of words. "Boaz has redeemed your family's property. He offered it to Nathan, the near relative, but Nathan could not do it, so Boaz has stepped in. The deal is already done." Rachel turns glowing eyes on Ruth. "And you, my dear, will be his bride." Anna's voice joins in, high-pitched and squeaky. The sisters clutch each other in a sideways hug, beaming. "Oh, my daughter," Mara breathes, clasping Ruth's wrist. Ruth turns to face her, and joy, true joy, unguarded, radiates from her mother-in-law's face. The old promise echoes between them. "Your people, my people, your God, my God. To see you upright again, this has long been my prayer." Mara's eyes glisten. "My Malon, he would want this, to see you happy, to see you settled, to see you..." She pauses, a heartbeat. "A mother at last." Ruth forces words past crowded memories, all caught in her throat. "You are sure he would not resent this?" "No, child." Mara presses a cool palm against Ruth's cheek. Ruth leans into it. "Malon would rejoice. He loved you enough to let you go, to wish for your happiness, even if..." She gives a brave and trembling smile. "Even after he was gone. If he could not grow old with you, he would be proud to see a man like Boaz step in." Ruth's tears spill, relief and surprise and sorrow and memory and happiness. Happiness she had forgotten the feeling, all mingled, raining down,